Before I proceed, I'd like to pay homage to the founders in whose honor this lecture has been instituted. Because we owe so much to them. To HPB, we owe theosophy. To Alcott, the Theosophical Society. And what would most of us or all of us be without these two precious gifts? So it's but right that one remembers them with deep gratitude and admiration. The subject of this evening is theosophy and the future of religion. But before we can speak about the future of religion, we must have some idea of what we mean by the word religion. Do we mean the religious system, or does the word religion convey something else, what we might call the religious spirit? These two seem to be different, in fact, contradictory. And perhaps if the future of the religious systems is well assured, then it will see the death of the religious spirit. If the religious spirit remains alive, then the system must weaken and perhaps will even die. Now let us look back into the past and have a brief view of the conflict between these two. The system has always insisted on conformity. In fact, without conformity, where would all the religious organizations and churches be? The part of the conformity lies in making people believe that the system is religion. So as long as people follow the system, they are induced into believing that they are religious. Conformity also means, of course, the acceptance of a given authority, a scripture, the interpreters of the scripture, the well-known dogmas, and so on. What are the scriptures? I can speak about the Veda because the Hindu religion was not one in which I was brought up, but which surrounded us everywhere. The Veda, it is said, is supreme knowledge, not man-made, but having a divine origin. And like any other scripture, it is supposed to contain absolute truth. The Vedas are written in a form of Sanskrit, Vedic Sanskrit, which it is difficult to understand. The first commentary was written or produced centuries after the Vedas came into existence. They were passed on orally, and the commentator tries to explain the meaning of the words. But even to this day, there is confusion about the exact meaning. And there are long passages which do not seem to be spiritually significant, which contain no deep philosophical content. Some parts of the Veda are even very objectionable. I won't try to describe why they are objectionable. There are, of course, the Upanishads, which are abstruse in parts, but all this is the Veda. And the scriptures of other religions are not different. What was the original Bible? It has undergone so many translations. Are the translations really accurate? Is it possible to translate important words into another language without twisting the meaning? I think of the word dharma in Sanskrit, very well known in the present day. But there is no Western word which conveys the meaning of dharma. And perhaps there were similar words in the original Bible. And then before the days of printing, what happened to the scriptures as they were transcribed again and again? Manuscripts went to pieces, and therefore new manuscripts had to be written, giving a golden opportunity to scribes and to those who commanded the scribes to introduce, delete, modify according to the convenience of the circumstances. I think we need not spend too much time on this, but the scriptures are of very doubtful authority, taken in toto. But people are told that the scriptures are authority, complete, literal, God-given, and so on. So conformity to the word, and then to the interpreters of the word. This is all part of the system. Who are the interpreters? Every scripture has created so much confusion. Not deliberately, but perhaps because there were paradoxical statements, parables, mystical statements, which have to be penetrated with the eyes of the spirit and not try to be understood by the intellect. It's amazing to think that among the Hindus, there are the three major philosophical and religious schools, all of which accept three texts as authority. And one of these schools is the non-dualistic school of Shankara. Another one is the dualistic school of Madhva. They both base their authority on the same text, but the interpretation is so different. Who is right? Of course, each one says that the truth lies in its bosom. And I'm sure among the Muslims, the Christians, and so on, every sect regards itself as the channel of truth. And of course, all the sects accept the Bible. They interpret the scripture in their own way. So we can't place faith in these interpreters, obviously. But people do, millions of people do, because they have been brainwashed so thoroughly. And the system exists in order to brainwash people. HPB, as usual, had some graphic words to describe them. She called them intellectual extinguishers. Enquiry has, therefore, is not encouraged, not only about the authority, but about any question. What happens after the body dies? There is no need for enquiry. If a person is a conventional Muslim or a Christian or a Hindu, he is told exactly what happens. What is the truth about reincarnation? It's also told to you. So everything is available through the mouths of others. There is no need to think. So the history of religion, if we look back, has been one of suppressing inquiry. And therefore, encouraging fanaticism and bigotry. It's a very sad history. Appalling cruelty has been perpetrated by the religions. Not only the cruelty of war, of persecutions, forcible conversions, crusades, so-called holy wars, but the cruelty of instituting customs and superstitions which gave more authority to the priesthood. In every religion, these customs existed which caused great suffering to various groups of people. Since we know about all this, we need not go into the details. And how have the religious systems managed to keep millions of people, generations of them, in a state of obedience and conformity, pouring their money for the benefit of the churches and the priests, doing what they were told, going to war, ready to die for stupid causes, because the system also was a system of instilling fear and obedience through fear. This system has always played on human credulity, the fear of death, the fear of the unknown. And therefore, people became compliant. I'm sure you are familiar with the famous letter number 10 of the Mahatma letters, where it is said, the greatest, the chief cause of nearly two-thirds of the evils that pursue humanity ever since that cause became a power, that is religion. It is religion under whatever form and in whatsoever nation. It is the sacerdotal caste, the priesthood, and the churches. It is religion that makes of man the selfish bigot, the fanatic that hates all mankind out of his own sect. The sum of human misery will never be diminished until the better portion of humanity destroys in the name of truth, morality, and universal charity the altars of their false gods. There is the other side of religion, of course, the religious spirit. And that can never be suppressed. So in spite of all these oppressive systems, there have been streams of religious teaching. And no one has been able to stop that. The Christian church tried, as you know, burnt Giordano Bruno and persecuted many others. What was Bruno persecuted for? Because he didn't agree with the church. He was speculating, inquiring. And one of his crimes was to say that the universal life is everywhere. I quote now, be it ever so small a thing, it has in it part of the spiritual substance, which, finding appropriate conditions, expands into a plant or an animal. There is not the minutest particle which does not contain such a portion in itself, which is not ensouled. There was a great Sufi, El Hallaj, who was also executed for daring to say that God is everywhere. And one can discover him most of all in one's own heart. He made the famous declaration, I am God. And that was the end of him. The communists have tried to suppress religion. Science has tried in its own way, or the scientific age has. But none of them have been able to succeed because of the very nature of the human consciousness. Julian Huxley said that man is a sadly incomplete creature. He is because he is meant to be self-aware. But the self-awareness does not stretch very far. However, he does become aware in some way of his own limitations. And there is that energy within his consciousness which is demanding that he push the frontiers out all the time, enlarge his understanding, his knowledge, his love, his sense of beauty. Because the very nature of consciousness is that it is knowledge, it is love, it is beauty. And this sense of limitation, of finiteness, is something that the human being cannot live with. So he has to inquire. He has to enlarge his relationship. He has to dig deeper. These activities correspond to what is within himself. Because essentially, he is of the nature of knowledge. He must inquire, know. He doesn't always understand in what direction he must search for knowledge, but this urge to expand his knowledge is irrepressible. And because he is love, he cannot be satisfied with limited relationships. There's something in all of us asking for a wider relationship, a greater love. And there is also something which says, I must go deeper. I must find out the essence of things, thereby know the beauty of all that exists. And I would like to suggest that the real religious spirit has proceeded in this direction, but it has required great courage to pursue the religious path, to follow the star within, which is the religious spirit. But like Bruno and El Hallaj, there have been those brave souls who have fought obscurantism, sacrificed their lives, resisted all the pressures of society, the compulsions which ask others to conform. And the true religious traditions or the authentic streams have all had their source in the living experience of these brave religious people. But these streams become polluted by others who are too lazy to search, to go deeper, to be self-aware, people for whom it is much easier to regard words as a religion and rituals, acts as worship. HPB, in one of her essays, says, all the religions are true at the bottom and all are false on the surface. But she also adds that the crust of error is thick. In 1887, writing about the main work of the Theosophical Society, which means the common work which all of us have to undertake, she said the following: the chief work so far of the Theosophical Society has been to revive in each religion its own animating spirit. By encouraging and helping inquiry into the true significance of its doctrines and observances. Of course, the inquiry may lead one to realize that certain of these observances and doctrines have no significance at all, but that is part of the inquiry. And she continued, "Theosophists know that the deeper one penetrates into the meaning of the dogmas and ceremonies of all religions, the greater becomes their apparent underlying similarity." Please note the words "apparent underlying similarity." Until finally, perception of their fundamental unity is reached. This common ground, that is the fundamental unity, is no other than Theosophy, the secret doctrine of the ages, which, diluted and disguised to suit the capacity of the multitude and the requirements of the time, has formed the living kernel of all religions. Even the living kernel, according to her, is a diluted and disguised version of Theosophy in the real sense of the term. But obviously, I think it's not difficult for us to understand, if we are real students of Theosophy, we cannot belong to any conventional religion. As long as we conform to the conventions, to the dogmas, then we can never find Theosophy. So inquiry is necessary, and it must be serious, not superficial, occasional inquiry to suit our moods. Because unless we go probing, questioning, since the crust of error is thick, we may get entangled somewhere. The essential unity she speaks of is not at the level of the forms of religion at all. A few years ago, Dr. Ravi Ravindra conducted a course in the School of the Wisdom at Adyar with the theme, "The Essential Unity of the Higher Religions." Because there is a certain kind of study of the unity of religions at the superficial level of what people do, their customs, the forms of worship, the dress they wear, and so on. But these forms are of very little importance, as little importance as the type of food which each one of us may prefer or the dress we like to wear. It's when we step beyond all this medley of customs and concepts, which for a time may appear coherent, but which are not, that we can come to the heart, which is Theosophy. And to do that, it is not by comparing and contrasting that we will succeed. I depend very heavily on HPB to put forward these ideas. So I will quote again what she says about Theosophy, presumably in the intellectual sense of the term. That is, the concepts, the doctrines, which together form the Theosophy we know, with all our limitations at present. She says its doctrines, that means the doctrines of Theosophy, if seriously studied, call forth, by stimulating one's reasoning powers and awakening the inner in the animal man, every hitherto dormant power for good, and also the perception of the true and the real as opposed to the false and the unreal. Is there something lacking in our study of theosophy? That do we also accept the doctrines of theosophy as the average person accepts the doctrines of his particular religion? If we are studying it, as she suggests, then it should stimulate our reasoning powers, our capacity to inquire, to question, not merely accept and believe, and do much more than that. That is, awaken our intuition, our perceptive power, so that we begin to sense rather than think what is the real and what is not. Mention was made this afternoon about the necessity to study various subjects or topics in theosophy in a deeper way. Karma, for example. To study the mechanics of karma is one thing, but to use the not only the reasoning power, but other faculties to find out what karma really signifies. How does it function so that it helps every person onwards on his evolutionary path? How does it stimulate the spiritual faculties? To understand all that is quite a different thing. So how do we study? Is our approach wrong? Is it one which is too similar to that of the average so-called religious person? Or is our motive false? Perhaps if we study theosophy in order to gain something for ourselves, if we get stuck with the words, if we are not really serious, if we don't think and contemplate deeply, we don't get very far, because then we are only bookish theosophists. We don't really know theosophy. And again, to go back to what HPB says, she refers to the Theosophical Society as a whole, but she says, those books which contain the most self-evident truth are to it, meaning the Theosophical Society, inspired, not revealed. But all books it regards on account of the human element contained in them as inferior to the book of nature. To read which and comprehend it correctly, the innate powers of the soul must be developed. Ideal laws can be perceived by the intuitive faculty alone. They are beyond the domain of argument and dialectics, and no one can understand or appreciate them through the explanations of another mind, even though this mind be claiming a direct revelation. And this applies to all books, to her books, to everybody's books. So, unless the books are used, as Krishnaji used to say, as a sort of a mirror in which you see the facts, as a guide to see something which is beyond the words, they may not really help. And real religion begins perhaps where we are no more dependent on books. When, with the aid of the books, or with the book, help of the book of nature, by our own observation, through very careful reasoning, we have learned to use the inner faculties and begin to sense, to start with and later to experience, the hidden nature of things. And there we may find the what unity really means. There is no other God except this unity, the one life. If we go back to that letter number 10 of the Mahatmas, they say that the God of the theologians is simply an imaginary power, a loup-garou, which means a werewolf. Our chief aim is to deliver humanity of this nightmare, to teach man virtue for its own sake, and to walk in life relying on himself instead of leaning on a theological crutch. A crutch that for countless ages was the direct cause of nearly all human misery. If people are willing to accept and to regard as God our one life, immutable and unconscious in its eternity, they may do so. So, as Dr. Annie Besant put it very simply, the essence of spirituality is the experience of unity. That is the essence of the religious life, of religion. And the religious spirit is one which is on this quest, which means that it is not satisfied with the words of others. It is not willing to accept rewards and punishments. It is not frightened of inquiry. It is not afraid of giving up its pet ideas, but is open to go deep into the nature of life and discover what the seers of the Upanishads call the truth of truths, the mystery of existence. HPB again says, to be a theosophist, one need not necessarily recognize the existence of any special god or deity. One need but worship the spirit of living nature and try to identify oneself with it, to revere that presence, the invisible cause, which is yet ever manifesting itself in incessant results. Indivisible in its essence and eluding form, yet appearing under all and every form, who is here and there and everywhere and nowhere, is all and nothing, ubiquitous yet one. The truly religious people, the real theosophists, have felt this presence. That is God consciousness. Otherwise, there is no other God. The God who is in every insect, every blade of grass, in the air and earth around us, in all that appears ugly or beautiful, it is there. As Bruno said, it is in every small thing. And to reverence that, to adore it even if we do not know it fully, perhaps is a religion. And in this sense, theosophy is God wisdom. Theosophy is a religion. perhaps we can change the title, and instead of saying theosophy and the future of religion, we might as well say theosophy is the future of religion. If we do not experience theosophy in this sense, not only we, but people everywhere, religion may have no future, because it will merely deteriorate into worse forms of the system. Theosophy is religion itself. You know that statement very well. And that the one bond of unity which is so universal and all-embracing that no man has no speck, from gods and mortals down to animals, the blade of grass and atom can be outside its light. This is HPB's definition of theosophy and religion. Again, she says, religion per se, in its widest meaning, is that which binds not only all men, but also all beings and all things in the entire universe into one grand whole. So the real theosophist is the truly religious person. And this knowledge, the knowledge of the universal life, its sacredness, is, as she says, a universal panacea for the ills of mankind, solving all problems. We are reminded of that other letter where it is said that philosophy and religion, in the true sense of the term, must have a solution for every problem. Sounds drastic, but in fact, it is the truth. Because if we can discover this, then there is no problem in life at all. There is no problem about what to do in any circumstances. That is why it is the fundamental question is how to be religious, which means how to be a theosophist. How to awaken the dormant faculty within ourselves so that we can see differently, as we have already been told. I would like to conclude by pointing out that there is no shortcut. It is no use looking for some formula, some trick. Expect that there can a new publication, a new revelation will make us wise. As one of the elder brothers said, the occult science is not one in which secrets can be communicated of a sudden by a written or even verbal communication. Every now and again the question arises, why don't the masters write letters anymore? What are we doing with them? We have so many instructions. Why haven't we benefited from them? If we receive more and more letters and bind them up, are we going to become wiser? Because the real truth cannot be communicated by word or in terms of concepts. We have to learn for ourselves, deep in our hearts. If it were possible to communicate so easily, I quote again, all the brothers would have to do, brothers means the elder brothers, would be to publish a handbook of the art which might be taught in schools as grammaries. We've got those handbooks, Light on the Path and so on. The truth is that till the neophyte attains to the condition necessary for that degree of illumination to which and for which he is entitled and fitted, most, if not all, of the secrets are incommunicable. It's possible to find dozens of quotations from illumined people, saints, holy ones, sages, who have all said that God is here, everywhere, all the time. Exactly what HPB has said in the passage which we have quoted. The truth is here now, but it's only the incapacity of our eyes which makes it impossible for us to know the truth. So our work, if we want to see the world become truly religious, which would be a great blessing, is to make ourselves fitted to receive the secrets. The receptivity must be equal to the desire to instruct. The illumination must come from within, says the Mahatma. Till then, no hocus pocus of incantations or mummery of appliances, no metaphysical lectures or discussions, no self-imposed penance can give it. I'm afraid in the present day there is a lot of all this hocus pocus of not only incantations but all sorts of things. But nothing of all that can really help. There may be many things which I shouldn't say nothing can help. There may be many things which help a bit, but which cannot do the trick for us. And the means to illumination have also been very clearly stated, not only in this particular letter, but in many other books of instructions, in different ways. But if we start on the process of inquiry, of reflection, of meditation, of purifying our perception, which means purifying our minds and hearts, then perhaps we will realize that the different kinds of instructions given by several different teachers all say more or less the same thing, but in different words. But in this particular letter, where the Mahatma says that these means have been empirically found by the experience of ages to conduce to illumination, they mention, among other things, chastity of thought, word, and deed. Probably wouldn't appeal to the modern person at all. But as one of the Mahatmas said, the rules are made in Shambhala and not in Simla. They said this to Sinnett, who thought that he could decide what was the right thing to do. Silence for certain periods to enable nature herself to speak. Government of the animal passions and impulses. The modern idea of freedom, perhaps, will not allow many people even to consider such qualifications. Utter unselfishness of intention, meditation. Qualifications are well known. They have been known throughout the ages, in all the different cultures, in one way or another. And our study of, comparative study of religions, can make us aware where the meeting ground is, that there are certain qualifications which seem to be essential. And unless one is prepared to experiment with them and train one's own nature, purify one's perception, it may not be possible at all to discover the truth and lead a truly religious life. So the question is whether we can know theosophy in this sense, in the deepest sense of the term. And by treading the path about which plenty of instructions have been given in theosophical books, in the broad sense of the term, the more we can live as theosophists and encourage others to live as theosophists, the more certain will the future of religion be. Certain in the sense that the more beneficial will the religious future of humanity be. Otherwise, it may be a very sad story in the future as it has been in the past.